sure I'm dressed okay? I asked, fidgeting with the plain navy t-shirt and jeans I'd been wearing when Andrea, who was even more pale and elegant than I remembered, arrived at my door an hour early. She'd insisted I was fine, though she was wearing a cashmere sweater and beautifully cut gray slacks. I was starting to wonder if this was some sort of attempt to humiliate me for hurting her feelings. She'd probably take me to the club, and all of the other vamps would be in black tie. And then she'd dump a bucket of pig's blood on me. "You look great," she said, stopping just outside the door of the cellar, a respectable-looking cement block building in an unassuming corner of Euclid Avenue. "You know that nobody's going to be wearing black leather and dog collars, right?" I shrugged. "I've never done this before. I didn't go to human bars. Mudslides aside, I'm not much of a drinker. Club people are not my people. Now, book club people." "These are your people, Jane, more than I am," she said, her voice thinning as she pulled me toward the door. "Is there a secret handshake?" I whispered. She shook her head. "I stay 2 paces behind you because I'm but a lowly human. You walk into the room as if you know that you belong, that you're one of them. Make eye contact with as many as possible. Keep your body language aggressive and rigid. You're an aloof, indomitable warrior queen who could fend off attacks from anyone in the room." She reached for the stainless steel door, repeating, "Aloof, indomitable warrior queen." I tensed every muscle in my arms as if I were going to punch the first person I saw, undead or otherwise. Of course, that person was a cuddly 65-year-old bartender, ironically named Norm, who was clearing pilsners off shiny bar tables. It was a sports bar, a smoky, noisy, all-American sports bar with dartboards and neon beer signs on the walls. Nobody looked remotely interested in kicking my ass. In fact, nobody even noticed when I came in. They were too busy watching the Cardinals game on an obscenely large plasma screen. I whirled on Andrea. "You suck."
"No, technically you do," she said, giggling. "I'm sorry, it was just so easy. You should have seen the look on your face."
"Just for that, I'm not biting you later," she sighed heavily. "Spoil sport." We sat, and Andrea ordered a dry martini and a special for me. I didn't know what that was, but Norm seemed to know her and didn't seem like someone who was going to slip garlic or rohypnol into my cocktail. I scanned the room, making a game of separating the vamps from the non-vamps. Norm was definitely human. He was familiar in an "I-think-I've-seen-you-at-church-before" way, and he seemed happy and comfortable slinging doctored beers to vampires. Somehow that made me relax. There were 2 human men mixed in with the crowd watching the baseball game. The vampires were your typical enthusiastic sports fans, cheering, hooting, and sloshing their drinks. The occasional splash of synthetic blood on their shirts was the only sign that something was amiss, besides the vampire Cubs fan sulking in the corner. A dishwater blonde male vamp, wearing faded jeans and a Virginia is for lovers t-shirt, sipped dark lager at the bar, ignoring the hullabaloo behind him. The rest of the table seated groups of vampire women, immersed in pastel drinks and naughty conversations. Maybe these were vampire housewives? Seriously, the scariest thing about this place was the sign advertising Karaoke Tuesdays. The idea of a drunk vampire belting "I Will Survive" off-key was somehow both compelling and terrifying. I was calm, comfortable, and ready for a good time when Norm returned with a martini, which he declared dry as dust, with a fond pat on Andrea's head. I got something frothy and the color of ripe cantaloupe. "What is this?" I asked Andrea, waiting for Norm to pass out of hearing distance.
"It's a smoothie."
Andrea watched as I took a tentative sip. It was good, fruity, with just enough coppery aftertaste. Andrea continued,
"A special smoothie. Fruit juice, vitamins, minerals, protein powder, and a little bit of, pig's blood."
"Pig's blood?" I yelped, spitting the smoothie back into the glass. Andrea shushed me.
"You let me drink pig's blood?"
Well, at least she didn't dump it on me.
"Shh," Andrea hissed. "Look, Norm uses pig's blood because the artificial blood doesn't mix well with the fruit juice. The enzymes make it go brown. And Norm has some ethical issues with serving human blood. Just try it. You'll like it. It's like a Zinfandel, light and sweet. At least that's what I'm told."
I'm not loving you right now, I growled at her, swallowing a mouthful. It wasn't bad, but I just couldn't get the visions of a pleading Porky Pig out of my head. This attitude was pretty hypocritical given my before-death enthusiasm for bacon.
See? Andrea asked brightly as I took another sip.
Good girl. Kiss my ass, I grumbled. Andrea ignored my grumpiness and gestured to the smoky barroom. So, what do you think?
It's okay, I admitted. Even with everything I've learned about vampires, I still expected moody lighting and goth kids reciting bad poetry. Consider me pleasantly surprised. A lovely rose blush tinted Andrea's cheeks. If she weren't such a nice person, it would really piss me off that she looked like a redheaded Grace Kelly. Andrea was as out of place here as, well, me in a gym. Andrea was probably not the type of person I would have spent time with when I was living. She was too put together, for one thing. She made my sister seem rumpled. But she was the safest person I knew who could navigate her way through the vampire underground, and I really wanted to make up for making her feel like a hooker. I'd already decided that if I was going to develop a healthy friendship with Andrea, whose last name was Byrne, by the way, I needed to know more than her deliciously rare blood type. I was not going to be able to feed from her again. It was far too intimate an experience, like making out with someone at the office Christmas party and spending New Year's week pretending that person hasn't felt you up. Not that I know what that's like. What I want is some answers, I said, picking a pretzel from the bowl on the table. Then, remembering the pot pie, I dropped it. You know, basic stuff. Who you are, where you're from, how you got into this line of work. You owe me, lady. Let's start with why you can pronounce all your vowels separately, O ye of little accent. I dutifully sipped my pig's blood as Andrea told me a sordid tale worthy of her own country song. Andrea was pulled into the vampire world just before the great coming out. She was a sophomore, studying information systems at the University of Illinois, when she met a vampire professor. Maxwell Norton, age 321, taught history, which was pretty unfair considering he'd been there when most of it happened. Norton, whose real name was Matthias Northen, scented Andrea's rare vintage blood type on the first day of class. He separated her from the class like a wounded gazelle and nurtured her as a pet. She watched over him during the day, fed him, picked up his dry cleaning, graded his papers. And in return, she was introduced to vampire society, like a debutante with really big veins. Norton taught her how to dress, to speak, to behave in a way that pleased his sophisticated undead friends. Then, 7 years later, Norton found a newer, fresher freshman pet and tossed Andrea aside, despite the fact that she dropped out of college and given up her life to be with him. Men. Even dashing, mysterious vampire men can be such bastards. Andrea had suffered from her own overbearing helicopter parents, the kind of people who calculated how every breath Andrea took reflected on them and their family. They accompanied her to job interviews, called her dorm room at least once a day to make sure she was up to date on her assignments and her flossing. But as soon as her loving relatives found out she was consorting with vampires, Andrea was unceremoniously pruned from the family tree. Her dad stopped payment on the tuition check, and her mother let Andrea know she was no longer welcome in the Christmas card picture. This may have been the point of her taking up with Norton in the first place. Vampires may bite you, they may bleed you, but they don't judge you. Andrea remained in the underground vampire community more out of necessity than anything else. Broke and lacking a degree, she found her rare blood type was the easiest and most lucrative way to make money. She moved to the Hollow to be near a friend she'd met through an online vampire pets community. She got a job in a boutique downtown that catered to riverboat tourists and the top 1% of Half Moon Hollow's socioeconomic caste. But her real income came from protectors who enjoyed her blood. She'd get a page, go to the client's home, and offer up her veins. She said many of her clients were lonely and often asked her to stick around to talk for a while. They were generous and more than happy to pass her name on to other respectable vampires. Apparently, her line of work was all about referrals. The only occupational hazards were the constant need for turtlenecks and trying to fit enough iron into her diet. I stuck with smoothies through the night because after the Kahlua episode, I decided that alcohol and I weren't friends anymore. It was nice just to sit and talk as we discussed childhoods, family dynamics, and men, with the exception of the one man we both wanted to talk about.
I deliberately skirted the issue of Gabriel and his relationship with Andrea, whatever that might be. It was cowardly, but Andrea seemed like my first shot at a friend who truly understood this new world I'd been dropped into. I didn't want to run the risk of alienating her. "So your experience hasn't made you want to avoid vampires altogether?" I asked. "I'd probably be out burning the undead in effigy. Not that I want to give you any ideas or anything."
"Vampires are just like humans," Andrea said. "You meet good ones and bad ones. Pulse has very little to do with it."
"Have you ever wanted to be turned yourself?"
"You know, I've never had a vampire offer to turn me," she admitted. "They can feed off me if I'm undead, but it's not as much fun, and the nutritional value of my blood drops. I guess they don't want to kill the golden goose, if you know what I mean. But I like living. I'm not afraid of death, which seems to be a problem for people who get turned, no offense."
"None taken," I assured her. "I was afraid. I wasn't ready to die. When I thought of the ways I preferred to die, I wanted to be 100 years old and surrounded by generations of adoring descendants, though a hairdryer and an ill-timed fall into a tub was far more likely. I never considered deer or drunk drivers."
"Well, it's certainly a more interesting story than a hairdryer and a bathtub," she said. "What about you? Tell me everything. Do you have a boyfriend, or..."
"I'm definitely in the or category," I snorted. "Let's see. The last guy I dated, is there a word for someone who's sexually attracted to Muppets?" Andrea's elegant persona was destroyed as she laughed so hard martini shot out of her nose. That made me feel pretty good. I regaled her with my epic tales of dating men too bizarre to allow past second base. The jobless, the spineless, the one who brought his mama on her first date. By the time I got to Derek, the man with an unnatural interest in Miss Piggy, most of the crowd had drifted out. It was just us, Norm, the teddy bear bartender, and the Virginia-loving lager drinker. I don't think Andrea had been out on many girls' nights because she went whole hog on the martinis. Given the late hour, the amount of vodka consumed, and her regular blood donations, it was impressive that she was still upright. But once she started actually watching the Australian Competitive Darts Championship on the big screen, I called for the check. We wandered out just as a gaunt, semi-mulleted vamp in a faded Whitesnake t-shirt came barreling in. Andrea, already unsteady on her feet, mumbled drowsily as she bumped into me. "Excuse us," I muttered, retrieving Andrea from her 130-degree lean. I had my droopy new friend tucked into her passenger seat when I realized I'd left my purse behind. I jogged back into the bar, opening the door on Mr. Whitesnake, literally holding Norm upside down by his ankles and shaking him. The lager drinker was nowhere in sight.
"Where's the cash, you useless sack of meat?"
Whitesnake snarled, his fangs in full play. Norm, who looked oddly resigned to this treatment, pointed to the wall behind the bar.
"Hey, put him down,"
I yelled, rushing to catch Norm when Whitesnake complied.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
I demanded, setting Norm on his feet.
"Punching some nosy bitch in the face."
"What?"
I managed before Whitesnake's fist collided with the bridge of my nose. Whitesnake stood 6 feet tall and looked as if he'd been blown out from a straw, and yet the sheer force of the blow threw me back through the bar door and skidding into the gravel of the parking lot. That did not feel good. My face felt as if it were located somewhere near the back of my head. I sat up, rolling my neck. My stomach dropped greasily at the sound of my vertebrae snapping back into place. I was shaking off that new entry in the ick files and wondering how the hell Andrea was sleeping through this when Norm came flying out the door. I loved that I was able to spring up and catch Norm's pudgy form before he was a smear on the parking lot. I did not love the look on Whitesnake's face as he came storming out of the bar.
"Run!"
I hissed as Whitesnake advanced. Norm, obviously accustomed to this occupational hazard, scurried to his nearby car, found his magnetic hide-a key, and pulled away in less time than it takes to say gratuity included. I turned my attention back to my face-rearranging buddy, who was seconds from slamming me like a rag doll into the hood of an old Mustang. Let me tell you, solid American engineering hurts. My legs flailed as I thumped back against the hood, landing a lucky kick to the side of his head. He flinched, letting me land another one, planting the toe of my canvas sneaker in his ear. It also gave me time to shove the heel of my hand under his chin, not to hurt him, but to direct his breath away from me. How could someone who didn't eat, or for that matter need to breathe, have breath that smelled like expired Parmesan cheese? The breath, combined with chapped lips and eyes that were "I just ate special brownies red," added up to someone I didn't want hovering close to my nose. I gave Whitesnake another quick punch to the mouth, his teeth scraping deep across my knuckles. I must have hit him hard because one of his canines clacked to the ground. I quickly surmised that fangs are the one thing we didn't grow back because he was really, really pissed about it. I barely got out an "oh, crrr" before I was splayed over the hood, gaining intimate personal knowledge of the hood ornament in a manner I'd rather not discuss again. With the pummeling, my head snapped back, and I caught a glimpse of Andrea dozing blissfully in the front seat. "A fat lot of help you are," I yelled, just before Mr. Whitesnake took this lapse of concentration as an opportunity to try to crush my skull with his bare hands. The popping noise my cranium made was something that would make my skin crawl for the rest of my long, long life. I made an embarrassing girly squeal as I tried to pry his fingers away from my scalp. Having exhausted my limited fighting skills, I resorted to the one thing that always worked in elementary school. I kicked Whitesnake in the nuts. And I was thrilled to find that it worked on men both dead and alive. He crumpled to the ground, howling. I sat up, postponing running and screaming long enough to let my skull knit back together. A bemused voice sounded from behind the car. "Okay, honey, I don't care what he's done to you. You just don't kick a man in his goods. It's just not done." Chapter 9. Try to avoid conflicts with other vampires until you can gauge their strength and control your own. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. The lager drinker had emerged from the bar to watch me get my ass kicked. How gallant. "I'll keep that in mind while I'm having my panties surgically removed," I griped after snapping my jaw back into its socket. I followed the sound of his laugh, focusing somewhat bleary eyes on the source of that smoky, smirky voice. It was one of those roguishly handsome faces, the ones that usually got me to do their homework in high school. Deep-set, seawater green eyes, high cheekbones, and a long patrician nose that had obviously been broken at some point. He was in his mid-30s when he was turned, but the smile and the crinkles around his eyes gave him an impish quality. He was the first vampire I'd met whose smile actually reached his eyes. And he was the only one I'd met who wasn't wearing leather in some form. "Jane Jameson." He grinned. "Like the porn star." I gaped at him. "What? No, Jane Jameson." "Oh, not as fun," he said, making disappointed clucking noises. He grinned and stretched out a long-fingered hand. "I'm rich." The introduction was interrupted when my now recovered opponent sprang up from the ground and lunged for my throat. I stepped out of the way as Rich caught the guy by his collar and jerked him back into a sleeper hold. "Now that's not very nice, Walter," Rich said, folding Whitesnake's arm into a painful origami formation. I could hear the bone creak toward breaking.
"That bitch broke my fang," yelped Whitesnake,
whose mystique was somewhat shattered by being named Walter.
"That's no way to talk to a lady. Now, say you're sorry," Rich said,
the mock patience in his voice in direct contrast to the snap, crackle, pop of Walter's ulna.
"Gah!"
Walter yelled, which was not the response Rich was expecting, judging from the way he jerked Walter's arm up. I'd never heard a bone break before. It was an experience I'd rather not repeat.
Blech.
I'd also rather not repeat what Walter screamed at Rich, which would guarantee me box seats in hell, as Aunt Jetty would say.
"That's no way to talk to me, Walter,"
Rich said, grabbing Walter by the scruff of the neck as the broken limb dangled.
"You've been warned about robbing the cellar. Norm's been given permission to dust your hide with silver shot. He just doesn't have the heart to do it, 'cause you don't have the sense to duck."
I protested that all this bone breaking wasn't necessary. I was fine, no harm done, and thanks to Walter, I was more than alert enough to drive home safely. Walter called me some very creative names and repeated his anatomically impossible instructions to Rich. Rich paused and watched Walter's arm set itself. Then he wrenched it again.
"Oh, come on, man," Walter whined.
"I can keep breaking it," Rich told him.
Now, do you have something to say to this lady?
Even I was disturbed at the display of testosterone. Really, this is just... Oh, come on. What's next? Screaming mercy is for the weak?
Rich actually shushed me, saying, there's a principle here.
Walter mumbled something close to, I'm sorry.
What was that?
Rich combined the pain of a crooked arm with the indignity of a flicked ear. I could only hope the situation didn't escalate to the dreaded purple nurple.
Walter shrieked, I'm sorry! I'm sorry!
Rich smiled brightly at me.
Happy?
No! I shook my head. This is just wrong!
Rich gave me a look, telling me he knew that some small, petty part of me was enjoying this.
He released a whining Walter, who rubbed his arm gingerly.
Walter, I want you to go home to your mama's, have a drink, and whatever you were planning to do with Norm's money, don't do it.
Walter sneered at me, told Rich he hoped an important appendage rotted off, waited a beat, then took off running.
Rich nodded to Walter's retreating form. That was Walter.
Walter had problems, Rich told me. He was a living example that being a vampire made you stronger and faster, but not necessarily smarter. Turned behind a bowling alley 5 years before, he still slept in his mom's basement and made a living selling pirated Knight Rider DVDs. It wasn't much of a living, because he robbed the cellar at least once every few months. Norm didn't even bother locking the safe anymore. I dusted the parking lot remnants off my jeans, glaring up at him. So I'm supposed to feel sorry for the guy who treats Norm like a human pinata and tried to pulverize my skull? He shrugged again.
No, but he's not very bright, so you can't hold it against him.
I winced as several parts of my head fused back together. And yet I think I will anyway.
I like you.
Rich grinned and bowed over my hand in a courtly manner.
Richard Cheney.
Nice to meet you, I said, shaking his hand under his nose, making it much more difficult for him to kiss.
Wait, Richard Cheney? As in Dick Cheney? You're a vampire named Dick Cheney? Somehow that makes you seem more evil. I was Dick Cheney first. I was Dick Cheney before he came along, and I'll be Dick Cheney after he's dead.
Sore subject? I asked. He nodded. I glanced back at the abandoned bar, its neon sign spattering forlornly against the gathering humidity.
What about the bar?
Dick made a gesture somewhere between a nod and a slouch.
I'll close it up. Norm gave me a key for nights like this.
How often are you here? He laughed.
You'd better go home now, Stretch. Sun's coming up soon.
Not a hot date for years, and suddenly I'm man bait, I muttered as I opened the car door. Andrea was still napping. I poked her rubbery, inanimate cheek and amused myself by giving her funny faces. Entree into the vampire world, my foot. As dawn pecked at my windows, I tucked a lightly snoring Andrea in on my couch and asked Jetty to wake her up in time to change for work. I knew I would wake up bright and early if invisible hands were yanking the pillow out from under my head. I took a long, hot shower. It was more than a little nauseating when the gravel was forced out of my healing knee wounds and plinked into the enameled metal tub. I also washed a half pound of grit from my hair and pulled a 7-inch sliver of windshield glass out of my shoulder.
That can't be good, I muttered, tossing it into the wicker wastebasket.
Apathetic about my nudity and the complications it could pose if I were confronted by a ragtag team of stake-wielding teenagers, I hung a thick quilt over the window and collapsed into bed. My last coherent thought was that I'd never retrieved my purse from the cellar. According to Jetty, Andrea left for work the next morning wearing an old church outfit of mine, which probably added up to the worst-dressed workday of her life. When I called her cell phone, she was driving two counties over to a client's house. Amused by my tales of parking lot fisticuffs, she gave me the background on Dick. Richard Allen Cheney lived in an old Airstream trailer out on Bend Road. Sort of blew those romantic castle and cape fantasies out of the water, didn't it? Andrea said the mobile life suited Dick's restless spirit, to know that he could pick up and move anytime he wanted. His only fear was a tornado coming along during the day and ripping the house off him. Dick was an old friend of Gabriel's, and when I say old, I mean 140-plus years. He was the last in a long line of dissolute men who were good with women and bad with fiscal responsibility. Dick's parents died when he was 18, leaving him a perfectly respectable house, a pitiful income, and the one servant the family hadn't had to fire. He was not exactly what Grandma Ruthie would call a reputable person. If you needed it, Dick could find it, but you shouldn't ask where he got it. I'm not talking about your typical illegal fireworks transactions. A werewolf once tried to stake Dick instead of paying him for a pistol that shot silver bullets. It was rumored that the werewolf was now a fur rug in Dick's badly decorated living room. It's a moot point to ask why the werewolf didn't shoot Dick with the silver bullet gun. Werewolves are sort of a crazy cousins of the supernatural world, Andrea explained. Not great at making decisions. Eager for a quiet night in, I dutifully read the chapters on finding blood sources and emergency sun protection from the Guide for the Newly Undead. The descriptions of spontaneous vampire combustion were going to give me nightmares for weeks. But now I knew not to trust a t-shirt pulled over my head to keep me from bursting into flames. Coats, heavy-duty trash bags, and high-quality aluminum foil would do in a pinch. I nuked a bottle of Flow Type O and poured over my personal library for something that would settle me. As usual, I came back to my dear Jane. Whenever I get restless or stressed, I revisit Mansfield Park, because I know that no matter how rough my life gets, at least I don't have to wear a corset and live with a stone-cold witch like Mrs. Norris. I propped my feet on the arm of my porch swing and settled in. I'd barely begun a proper scratching of Fitz's ears when a set of brass knuckles came flying at me. I caught it a few centimeters from my forehead. "That's so cool," I marveled. I turned to see Dick Cheney, the vampire, not the former vice president, climbing onto my front porch. Fitz lifted his head as Dick sauntered past, but dropped back into the scratching position without so much as a bark. "I figured you might want them the next time you get into a bar fight," he said. "I didn't want to say anything last night, but you hit like a girl, Stretch." I gave him my best "don't underestimate me" look and muttered, "A vampire girl." He sauntered over to the swing and made himself comfy, despite my objections when he stretched my legs over his ancient jeans. Not bothering to adjust the "I Know Tricks" t-shirt that rode over some impressive abs, he took particular pleasure in examining my brand new cotton candy pink pedicure. "I do admire a woman who pays attention to her toes. So, what do you have planned for the evening? And where is that tasty friend of yours?" I tossed the brass knuckles into his lap, drawing a wince from him. "She's not here, and she won't date you." He grinned, splitting the rugged planes of his face with brilliant white fangs. "She might, if she knew me." "She does know you, and that's why she won't date you." He gave me his best panty-dropping smile. "I guess I'll have to settle for you, then." Unable to decide whether that was an insult, I ignored him. "There's something familiar about you," he said. "I can't quite place it, but you're different." "It's my shampoo," I said, a smidge too loudly. "It smells like mangoes. Very memorable." "Nope, that's not it," he said, then squinted at me and gave up. He poked my side, instinctively aiming at my most ticklish places. "How come we haven't met before? How old are you? What do you do when you're not losing fights and quipping me half to death?" "I grew up around here," I said, slapping his hand away. "I was just turned last week. I'm a librarian." He stilled as if I just told him I was the inventor of the tube top. "I watched a movie about a librarian once. Well, she was a librarian by day, a call girl by..." I stopped him with a quick lift of an eyebrow. "If you finish that sentence, we cannot be friends." "You don't talk like a librarian," he said. "I know," I admitted. "I'm proof that just enough education can be dangerous. In the right setting, I can argue Faulkner and James Joyce with the best of them. But I think it's going to take a couple of centuries to polish the hollow off me. My sire's pretty urbane. Maybe he can send me to vampire charm school or something." "I kind of like it," He smirked and turned his attention to the gardens. I knew your family growing up. Came to a couple parties here at River Oaks. I was, friendly with your several times great aunt, Ceci. I glared at him. Dick glossed over the subject. The gardens were never this pretty, though. My mother used to have a garden like this. She liked to leave it kind of wild, but you could see the thought she put into it. She loved her roses. So did my Aunt Jetty, I said. I'm barely keeping them alive. I'm better at reading about gardening than the actual gardening itself. But Jetty liked it when I would tell her what the roses meant. You know, white roses mean purity, red roses mean passionate love. Oddly enough, blue roses signify mystery, the real mystery being that there is no such thing as a naturally blue rose. Roses can't produce a chemical called delphinidin, which makes flowers blue, so florists have to dip them in chemicals to turn them blue. Even as I was talking, a voice inside my head was yelling, "Shut up, shut up, shut up!" Dick seemed impressed, but a little frightened. "You must really like flowers." "I like finding symbolic meanings in everyday things," I said. "You know, the meanings in some Victorian floral guides conflicted, so sometimes couples sent each other mixed messages. I like the idea of some proper English lady breaking her parasol over a suitor's head because he sent her yellow carnations, thinking it meant affection, but in her book it meant rejection and disdain." Dick stared at me a long time before saying, "You're Jane?" My head snapped up. Gabriel closed the 50 yards to my front door in a few strides. He did not look happy, and he was carrying my purse. My feet dropped to the porch. Fitz lifted his head and let out a huff, but didn't move. Dick remained in his casual, cozy pose, a smug grin spreading like molasses.
"Well, if it isn't my good friend Gabriel. How are you, son?"
"What are you doing here?" Gabriel demanded. Dick squeezed my shoulder in a chummy gesture.
"We're writing a vampire children's book. See Dick and Jane Bite. What do you think?"
If looks could kill? Well, Dick was already dead, so nothing would happen. But Gabriel was not laughing.
"See Dick,"
Dick said, pointing at his chest. He then swept his hand dangerously close to mine.
"Jane. Dick and Jane. Come on, you humorless jackass, that's funny."
"Do all vampires know one another?" I asked, fending off Dick's languidly resting hand on my knee. It was obviously for Gabriel's benefit. The last thing I needed was to be caught up in some bizarre undead male pissing contest.
"Only vampires who are best friends from the cradle," Dick replied.
"But Gabriel here likes to pretend that we've always been archenemies."
"How do you two know each other? You didn't lose a fight with him, too, did you?"
My response was not ladylike at all, which pleased Dick beyond an appropriate measure. After a beat, Dick scowled, leaned close, and sniffed my hair.
"You're her sire?"
Dick frowned.
"Should have picked up on that. She's not your type at all, Gabe. She can string a sentence together. And she's not evil."
"Thanks," I said, ducking my head away. What was with vampires and hair smelling? Did that mean Gabriel had scented my hair? Like a cat? Note to self, buy clarifying shampoo immediately. Gabriel ignored Dick, focusing on me.
"Jane, where did you go last night?"
"Not in love with your tone right now," I told him.
"I'll use a more cheerful tone when I have more cheerful news," he said. "Where did you go last night?"
"The cellar." He shot Dick the icy glare of death.
"With whom?"
"With me," Dick offered.
"We had a very memorable encounter in the parking lot."
"That's not what it sounds like," I said, elbowing Dick in the ribs.
"Jane, did you get into a fight with a vampire named Walter?"
I gave him my own lukewarm glare of malaise. "A low-life, scum-sucking old man-shaker named Walter, yes."
"He's dead," Gabriel said.
Dick snorted.
"Yeah, he's dead. You're dead. I'm dead. We're all dead. I thought you knew this stuff."
At this point, I think Gabriel was blocking out Dick's mere presence with some sort of meditation exercise.
"No, Jane. Walter is permanently dead."
He was locked in the trunk of his car, and the car was set on fire.
He could have done that to himself, I exclaimed.
Dick considered that for a moment and nodded. Gabriel gave me the stern face.
This isn't funny.
I held up my fingers, measuring this much humor.
It's a little bit funny. I thought we turned to ashes and dust when we were permanently killed. How do they even know it's Walter in the trunk?
His wallet and other personal effects were found with him, Gabriel said. Your purse was found near the car.
I left it at the bar last night.
What's going on? Are the police going to come knocking on my door? Suspicious vampire deaths are not investigated by the living authorities, Gabriel said, in a professorial tone that made me want to nibble on his earlobes until one of us lost consciousness. Gabriel was still talking. The victims are officially dead anyway, so the humans figure why bother? Anytime a human kills a vampire, human law enforcement considers it self-defense, something the World Council has been trying to change for years. Either way, the undead are strongly discouraged from killing one another without good reason. Losing a back-alley fight is not considered sufficient cause to set someone on fire.
Why would I set fire to someone I barely know, and then leave my purse next to the car so the authorities could be sure to track me down? And I didn't lose the back-alley fight, I just didn't win it, I corrected.
Gabriel stared. Fine, I lost. But Dick came along and helped settle the disagreement. Walter walked away. I took Andrea home with me and went to bed. Alone, I added when Dick opened his mouth. Dick can vouch for the fact that when I left that parking lot, Walter was alive.
I don't think using Dick as a character witness is going to help you, Gabriel said.
Dick considered that for a moment and nodded.
She didn't do anything, Gabe, Dick said. She was just trying to keep Norm from getting hurt. Even the council will be able to see that.
Council? I squeaked. But neither of them noticed, what with all the seething and male posturing.
As your sire, I have to take you before the local council to answer some questions, Gabriel told me. I would suggest you put on some more suitable clothes.
I looked down at my clothes. Apparently, pajama pants imprinted with little cupcakes were not suitable. I ran inside to change into khakis and a respectable blouse, reluctant to leave Dick and Gabriel alone for fear they might say something interesting in my absence. When I came back out, it appeared they hadn't said anything at all. Gabriel was leaning against the porch railing, arms crossed and eyes narrowed at his old friend. Dick was stretched out on my swing, scratching my adoring dog. Fitz had roused himself enough to sit up and place his head on Dick's knee.
You'll be fine, Stretch, Dick assured me with a wink. See you later.
Gabriel glowered at Dick as he opened the door to his car, a rather sedate Volvo sedan. It was disappointing, despite the total destruction of every preconceived vampire notion I'd had in the last week. The car smelled of old leather and not much else. It was a refreshing change from my car, which smelled faintly of bacon cheeseburgers. Dick didn't bother leaving before we pulled away. He stayed stretched across my porch swing with my dog's head on his knee. He even blew me a little kiss as I left. I'm sure it was meant to make Gabriel wonder whether he would still be there when I returned. I bounced between being annoyed and somewhat flattered that he was using me to irritate Gabriel. I settled on annoyed. I had no idea what awaited me at the council hearing. After the initial coming-out chaos subsided, the World Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead appointed national and state-level commissions to look into suspicious vampire deaths and record the newly turned. Those state councils had local representatives to settle minor squabbles and determine what matters were worth the higher-ups' attention. They were also granted authority to carry out sentences for the council. Gabriel drove in seething silence until we reached the edge of town. As we pulled to a stop on Gate Street, he tightened his fingers around the steering wheel and spat.
I can smell him on you.
Who?
You know who,
he snarled. Is this about Dick? I finally asked. He growled. I crossed my arms, as much to put a barrier between our bodies as to communicate my exasperation. So it's about Dick. Not to be obvious, but wasn't it always? He pulled me to face him in my seat, his face dangerously close to mine.
I need to make something very clear. I'm not your friend, Jane. I'm not Zeb. I can't spend time with you if you're going to be with someone else.
I want you to really, really listen to me, because I say this with all sincerity, I whispered, pressing his hands between mine. You are not a well man.
Don't make a joke out of this, he growled.
I'm not kidding, I growled back. What the hell do you mean you're not my friend?
And I haven't been with anyone, thank you very much. You'd know that if you really paid attention with that nose of yours.
Look, Dick was actually really helpful last night. He probably kept Walter from cracking my skull. And he came over tonight to make sure I was okay, I told him.
That's it. Nothing happened. I mean, he touched me, but not in the way you're thinking. And smelling me to determine whom I have and haven't been around is not an appropriate use of vampire powers. In fact, it's kind of pathetic. Your light's green.
Gabriel finally noticed the changed traffic signal and punched the gas. He smoldered for a few beats before he burst out with,
You know he lost his family's house in a card game, yes?
Dick lost his house to you in a card game, I sighed. Andrea had acquainted me with this interesting tidbit. Before they returned, Gabriel and Dick spent much of their time bouncing between the card table, Dick's hobby, and the horse auctions, Gabriel's hobby. One night after several hands of poker and too much of Dick's brandy, Dick wagered the family home against Gabriel's prize stallion. Dick was too drunk to realize he was holding 2 8s, a 7, a jack, and a 2, not a straight. Though Gabriel tried to give the house back, Dick was too proud to take it. This was fortuitous, as the Cheney manse was where Gabriel ran when his brother staked him out. Between the humiliation of Dick's loss and Gabriel's new knights-only policy, let's just say they were no longer BFFs. Petty grievances and snarky exchanges compiled until they went from not being able to stand each other to open hostility. Dick's propensity for penis-related quips and juvenile pranks didn't help. In the late 1960s, he peppered Gabriel's entire house with silver filings. For more than a decade, Gabriel couldn't sit without minor burns to his behind. So, despite living within a 10-mile radius of each other for more than a century, they didn't speak unless they had to. By the way, before you start making assumptions, Dick was not turned by the same woman who turned Gabriel. According to Andrea, Dick was turned 10 years after Gabriel, after a particularly bad card game. The winner, a vampire from New Orleans named Scat, wanted to make sure Dick's debt was paid off and figured giving him an extra few hundred years would help. Notice a gambling pattern here?
You should not spend time with Dick Cheney, I nodded.
Especially if he's holding a hunting rifle. He tipped his head back and roared in, I'm seriously reconsidering my I don't hit girls policy frustration. Feel better now? I asked.
No,
Gabriel yelled as he turned into the Hollow's mall area. Most of the city's large chain restaurants and businesses were clustered here, circling the wagons against cranky local merchants and customers who didn't understand why any store would have a returns policy that required a receipt instead of just trusting the customer's word. The neon signs seemed so bright it hurt to look directly at them, their aggressive reds and greens leaving little spots against my closed eyelids. We passed the full parking lot at Shenanigans, and I was struck by how different I was since the last time I'd driven down this road. The Jane who mourned a lost job and a half-lived life at the bar seemed happier, even in her misery, because she didn't have to deal with angry sires and blood and a murder rap.
How much trouble am I in? I asked, finally breaking the quiet.
I don't know, he admitted quietly. I've never heard of one vampire killing another so soon after rising.
Do you honestly believe that I could do something like this? Why would I set fire to someone I hardly knew?
As opposed to someone you know well, he snorted.
I'll take care of the sarcasm here, thank you, I told him. Honestly, do you believe I could do something like this?
He waited for a distressing amount of time before saying,
No.
Then why are you hauling me into court? I demanded, ashamed of the whine that was creeping into my voice. I thought vampires had this whole lawless, unholy rebel thing going.
Some feel that way, he said. Others, like me, believe that if you're going to assimilate into the modern world, you have to have some accountability for what you do.
Well, that made me feel horrible. He stared at the parking lot ahead, unable even to glance in my direction.
Just be respectful. Don't talk back. Don't volunteer any extra information. Don't demonstrate your unique brand of humor.
Basically, don't be me, I grumbled. If I wasn't paralyzed by fear, I'd be offended by that.
Chapter 10. The World Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead was created to protect the rights and interests of vampires of all ages. If you are summoned by a council official, it is in your best interest to respond promptly and answer all questions honestly. Hiding from the council will only work against you. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. I expected the local council to be a cross between the Lions Club and a Scorsese-esque panel of mafiosi. How mafiosi would end up in Kentucky, well, I hadn't really thought that through. Any self-respecting mafioso wouldn't be caught dead at Cracker Barrel at 9 on a weeknight. Yes, the council, the grand overseers of justice and decorum among the vampires of Region 813, held their secret meetings under an old metal sign advertising Lux Soap. Generally, you don't find vampires in well-lit places surrounded by unpleasant human food smells and an aggressively homey atmosphere. Gabriel explained that meeting in such a neutral, crowded environment was the only way to ensure that nothing would be overheard. Humans tend to be pretty focused when it comes to comfort food. The panel ordered Mama's pancake breakfasts and pushed the food around their plates. They were no different from any other customers, except for leaving healthy tips. Gabriel found the council members at their usual table. The panel consisted of Peter Crown, pale, gaunt, dyspeptic. It was clearly communicated that he did not like me, or Gabriel, or the other panel members, or the people eating pecan waffles at the next table. I think someone turned him into a vampire as a punitive measure. They wanted him to be pissy for all eternity. A Colonel Sanders look-alike, improbably named Waco Marchand. He didn't speak to Gabriel, but greeted me with a polite kiss just over my wrist. My hand smelled like peppermint and hair tonic for the rest of the night. A blonde lady with a slight British accent, who went by Sophie. Just Sophie. That was as close to Cher as we got in the Hollow. She was turned in her mid-40s. Her face was unlined and unpainted, leaving a plastic sheen to her skin that was beguiling and disquieting at the same time. She was confident enough not to wear any accessories with her rather fabulous black pantsuit. Ophelia Lambert, a willowy brunette, was wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and a locket that was probably 300 years old. Ophelia could have been 300 years old, but she appeared to be about 16. Her dewy, youthful looks conflicted with the imposing presence, a sort of, "Yes, I look as if I read Tiger Beat, but I can remove your spleen without blinking," attitude. She was almost as scary as some of the girls from my high school. Council members were assigned to their precincts regardless of origin, so Ophelia and Sophie's continental presence wasn't all that strange. I did, however, believe I recognized Mr. Marchand from a Confederate memorial statue downtown. Ophelia, who was apparently the head of the panel, motioned for us to sit at the crayon-scarred round table. A brown-aproned waitress named Betty arrived promptly to take our orders. Mama's pancake breakfasts all around, and we wouldn't see her for another 45 minutes. Despite the gravity of the situation, I couldn't concentrate on the members of the council. Sitting in a crowded human environment was an assault on the senses. Conversation from other tables hovered around us in needling mosquito clouds. And the bacon, which I had loved so much in life, kind of smelled like baby vomit. I concentrated on my silverware, shredding the paper napkin ring into tiny strips and twisting them into long coils. "Do you know why you're here?" Ophelia finally asked, her eyes as flat and still as a shark's as she spoke to me. I hesitated. If there was ever a time for me to cure my chronic babbling, this was it. "I was told that you have some questions for me." Gabriel inclined his head slightly as if to tell me I was off to a good start. We'd agreed that if I was being inappropriate or started to jabber, he would tap me with his foot under the table. Head nodding was a sign that I'd said or done something appropriate. It was demeaning, but I didn't want to dwell on it. The council stared me down, clearly expecting more.
I'm told that a vampire was killed last night, I said.
A vampire you attacked just hours before he was locked in his trunk and set on fire, Sophie pointed out.
I contend that it's possible Walter did that to himself.
No response from the panel beyond quirked lips from Ophelia. Gabriel kicked me under the table.
Now why was a nice young lady like you tussling with some no-account like that?
Mr. Marchand asked, shaking his head in fatherly distaste.
I objected to the way he was holding Norm, the human bartender, upside down and shaking him like a piggy bank, I said with as little irritation as possible.
Walter and I disagreed. Dick Cheney intervened. Walter drove away. I drove home. Andrea Byrne, whom I believe is well known in the vampire community, stayed on my couch, and she can't tell you much because she was essentially passed out drunk during the fight. I need to find a new way to tell stories, I added lamely.
Listening to the words in your head before you say them might help, Sophie suggested kindly. She stretched out her hand.
I felt compelled to take it. As soon as I was within range, she clutched my wrist and dragged me close, wrenching me against the table.
Hey! I grunted.
Something was wrong. My hand itched. Sophie's fingers were burning into my skin. I gasped, frantically trying to jerk away from her grip. Gabriel's finger slid under the table and clutched my other hand. His head shook. I was supposed to accept this treatment quietly.
Don't interfere, Gabriel, Ophelia warned.
Gabriel's hand slipped away, leaving me adrift.
Look into my eyes,
Sophie commanded, her voice stripped of the charm she was slathering on just a few seconds before. Hoping that I could still glower effectively through the pain, I met her gaze. Her irises flared to black, and then I was plummeting, dropping through bottomless space. My head seemed so heavy, too heavy to lift. Images of people and tables whizzed past without form or focus.
What are you doing?
I mumbled, my tongue thick and heavy. My voice sounded far away. I wanted to open my eyes, but the lids wouldn't budge. My stomach pitched.
Oh, please, please don't let me throw up in the middle of a Cracker Barrel.
Sophie is what you might call a walking lie detector, Ophelia said, her tone cheerful. Her gift allows her to search through your thoughts, sift the truth from what you want us to believe. It will be a difficult, painful procedure if you resist. Now, I want you to tell us again. What happened to Walter? The sting from Sophie's grip was wildfire, scorching from my arm to my chest. Hot iron claws were digging into my throat, scraping out words. I don't remember what I said. I just know I said it quietly. Overall, I'd have to rank the experience just under unanesthetized root canal. That settled it. Gabriel was officially my worst date ever. On the upside, I was able to relocate my tongue as Sophie's grasp loosened.
Let go of me,
I wheezed. My mouth tasted odd, like rusty nails. I smacked my dry lips and stared angry holes through Gabriel.
Oh, don't make a fuss, Sophie said lightly. I'm going to let you go now. You did well.
I wish I could have pulled enough words together to respond with appropriate scorn, but I think I was better off silent and nauseated. Gabriel tried to rub a hand across my shoulders, but I growled at him. If the humans at the next table noticed, they didn't look up from their waffles. Sophie said,
"She's telling the truth, or at least what she believes is the truth. She's so young. Sometimes it's hard for them to tell the difference."
Crown smiled at me. More nasty mockery than friendly gesture. That pissed me off, and I had just gained enough control over my limbs to jerk my hand away from Sophie.
This is not how people behave in a Cracker Barrel, I hissed.
I snarled at my sire, who had turned the gentle pressure on my foot into an all-out toe-stomping.
We did tell you that the process can be unpleasant, Sophie said with a small smile of apology. It could have been much more painful.
We have already spoken to Andrea Byrne, Ophelia said in a tone perfect for pronouncing judgment. She is one of the few humans whose word could sway our opinion. We are willing to believe your account for now, but you should be aware that we will continue to investigate Walter's death. If the attack was justified or we find that you are innocent, you will have our deepest apologies. However, if we learn that you have lied to this council,
You will be severely punished. Andrea will be punished along with you.
If you don't mind my asking, I croaked, if you were going to use Ms. Polygraph over there, why did you ask me to tell my side of things before?
Ophelia offered the barest of shrugs. To see if you would tell us the truth without assistance. If your version of events is, in fact, the truth. Also, we enjoy scaling the punishment to fit the depth of your deception.
If I might be so bold as to question the council further, what could punishment mean? I asked.
If I didn't know that my toe bones would regenerate, I would have been very upset about the crushing pressure Gabriel was applying to my foot. Ophelia smirked.
You could have a choice of being locked in a coffin full of bees or having a red-hot silver poker shoved up your...
Ophelia!
With an apologetic glance my way, Mr. Marchand interrupted her.
That's enough.
She's only joking, Sophie assured me. The silver poker is actually at room temperature. Ancient vampires call it the trial.
I asked, why?
Because it sounds incredibly scary.
Sophie nodded. I was dismissed before my pancakes were served, which was better in the long run. I probably would have found uneaten pancakes singularly depressing. Gabriel escorted me to the car before I could say anything else incriminating. And by escorting, I mean he dragged me across the parking lot like a caveman and ushered me none too gently into the front seat.
What the hell was that? I yelled. Having fully recovered the use of my arms and legs, I seized the opportunity to swing at him as he slid behind the wheel.
Did you know they were going to do that to me? In a coffin full of bees? What the hell?
Calm down. Just calm down, he said, catching my wrists.
I thought he meant to stop the hitting, but he was examining my reddened skin, poring over the marks left by Sophie's truth-seeking expedition into my brain. I remained quiet long enough to watch them evaporate away. I had a feeling it would sting for a while longer.
What is wrong with you people? I demanded. Why didn't you tell me they were going to go digging around in my brain? You know, I was raised to believe the contents of someone's brain are that person's own business. And have you noticed how often I yell at you?
Jane, I know you were frightened.
I was terrified, you ass!
He was across the front seat with my face between his palms before I knew what hit me. Despite being extremely pissed, I'm not going to say I didn't like kissing him. Or that I didn't kiss back. Because, damn. I mean, damn, he was some kisser. If our first kiss was sparklers and fireworks, this was a full-scale nuclear detonation. My whole body was involved. Face, lips, hands, thighs, legs. I don't think he was actually touching all of those parts. I just know they were involved. The sweep of his tongue across my lip was subtle at first, then increasingly demanding, until I couldn't tell where his mouth started and mine ended. He pulled me onto his lap, anchoring my ankles on either side of his thighs with his hands, stroking exposed skin with his thumbs. I tugged at his hair, pulling his head back so I could kiss that little thumb-shaped depression in the middle of his chin. Gabriel grunted, protesting my mouth leaving his. He brought me back to his lips, one hand cradling my head as the other kept my hips pinned to his. A minivan pulled into the spot next to ours. I could hear the gasps and then giggles of the three teens who were piling out with their parents. One of the kids yelled, "Geez, get a room!" I broke away from Gabriel, moving across the seat, ignoring the snickers of the kids as they walked away. I stared at him for what I'm sure was an alarming amount of time. I hadn't had a kiss like that in, well, ever. I'd finally found something simple and natural about my relationship with Gabriel. Making out with him. Yay for me. Just as I'd managed to produce that coherent thought, he was back on my side of the car again and giving me a repeat performance. It caught me off guard, and I accidentally bit down on his bottom lip hard enough to draw blood. The good news was he liked that, so I came off as provocative, not inept.
If that was an attempt to shut me up, screw you, I panted after he let me go a second time.
Through my hair, where his face was buried, he muttered,
I did it because I wanted to. Shutting you up was an added side benefit.
I shoved at his shoulders. Ass.
You said that already.
He said, his fingers tracing the lines of my jaw. Meant it this time, too.
Jane, I know you were frightened. I know their methods of questioning can be a bit brutal, but that was necessary, he said, pulling me tighter against his chest.
I rested my forehead against the hollow of his throat,
happy to find comfort even for a few moments. Having your brain scoured is an emotionally unsettling experience. I know you're angry with me for bringing you here, he murmured, but failing to answer the council would have caused far more problems. And as your sire, I'm responsible for presenting you to the panel. I'm responsible for watching over you in these first weeks. Obviously, I haven't been doing a very good job.
That's pretty insulting, I said, poking his ribs.
Gabriel finally said, I'm sorry.
Excuse me? I said, cupping my hand around my ear. What was that?
I'm sorry, he said again. I'm sorry for being so abrupt with you at your house. I'm sorry for blowing up at you over spending time with Dick. I'm sorry for being so unsettled around you. I've never spent time with a child I've made. There are complications I didn't expect. I have this overwhelming need to protect you, and you're making it very difficult.
Why haven't you ever spent time with a child?
It hasn't been possible, he said in a voice that brooked no further questions. And even if you weren't my child, I would feel this way. We're connected, you and I. That's why seeing you with Dick tonight was so unnerving. He's always had a way with the ladies, and you're exactly the kind of woman he enjoys corrupting. The idea of some other man touching you, kissing you, smelling him on your clothes, your skin, I couldn't take it. Between that and the council summons, I overreacted.
So it's not that you like me, it's that a biological function is making you jealous, I muttered.
Yes, wait, no, he howled. Why do you always reduce me to a blithering idiot?
This is blithering? I grinned. For me, he admitted. I had to concede that one. You smell him on me? I asked, sniffing my shirt. What does he smell like to you? To me, it's all lust and bergamot.
Uselessness, he grumbled.
He tipped his forehead to mine and kissed my temple, my forehead, the bridge of my nose.